Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and today my guest is Roger Friedman. Roger is a retirement strategist and wealth advisor with over 40 years experience and the author of 7 books, including the bestseller, Erasing America, Broken Politics, Broken Country. And he's also a proud member of the Sons of the Legion. And today we're going to talk about his father's Army story and how veterans can share their military experiences with their families and the importance of preserving these stories for future generations. Before we get into that, though, Roger, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Scott, thank you. I've been excited about being a guest on it, and today's the day.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start off, just share a little bit about your background and your father's, kind of what inspired you to write your father's Army story.
Well, I'm a New York City kid. My dad had a laundry and dry cleaning store right at Times Square. So he was kind of a Times Square entrepreneur. When he was called up for the Army Air Force, he was attending Pace journalism classes. And that got interrupted by World War II. And when he came back, he ended up not going back to school, but helping his parents with the laundry. And at the time, there was, I think, one employee, you know, with a washboard. You remember those things?
I know what you're talking about.
You know, first came the rock, then came the washboard, you know, then the washing machine. So, and I watched, I had a bird's eye seat watching as he grew that business to several dozen employees, a couple of trucks, and he became one of the best laundry and cleaners in New York City. He did work for hospitals and other laundries that did not have their own machinery, but he was also doing Broadway shows because we were literally 20 feet from the Lyceum Theater on 45th Street. And we did the Macy's Day Parade, you know, the Thanksgiving parades. And I remember trying on Mr. Green Jeans jeans that were gigantic, you know, for a 7-year-old. But I basically had a ringside seat to watch him succeed as an entrepreneur. And mentally, I took careful notes. And he worked like a dog, 12, 13, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I remember a long time ago, I remember reading an article about Trump when he was still running the Trump Organization. He was in Trump Tower, and they said he had a spiral notebook on his desk and a pen. And every day before he went home, he wrote down the most important things that needed to be accomplished the next day. You and I would call that a to-do list.
Sure.
Okay. And he would prioritize them with A's, B's, and C's. Guess what? My dad did that also. Did Donald learn it from Andy, or did Andy learn it from Donald? I will never know.
Well, I think that's a chicken and the egg kind of thing. You know,
yes.
Which one came first, right? So,
yeah. But I had a bird's eye seat to that.
Well, and so it seems like you were pretty close with your father then, you know, growing up.
A while, see, I was the kid with the behavior issue. I was never arrested, okay? But I did have behavior issues. My mom passed away when I was 12. So my dad had to keep an eye on me, and my brother and my sister were not up to the task. So many days after school, I went to the store to help out. In other words, he keeps an eye on me while I do everything wrong. Okay.
Yeah.
And for summers and Saturdays, I worked at the store for years and years and years. And Scott, I got to tell you, I hated it.
Mm-hmm.
I hated it. Think of the summer in a laundry with all the steam and the washing machines, 110 degrees, you know, kind of like Arizona or Texas, I guess.
Except for with the humidity. Yeah.
Yeah, but you had all the humidity. And so I hated doing that. And I would always find a reason to go up to the air-conditioned office where my dad had his desk, because he was on the phone all day with customers. And I said to myself, I don't want to do this. The business was eventually handed to me on a silver platter, and I said, no mas, you know, I don't want it.
Yeah. Well, and so you spent a lot of time with him, obviously, you know, whether you wanted to or not, it was one of those sort of situations.
Yeah.
And so did your father ever really talk about his experience in the Army?
You know, he never, ever did. And Let me show you my dad. Okay. That's Andy Friedman.
Sure.
Sergeant. And, here are my dad's dog tags. But other than showing me the dog tags one day, he never, ever spoke about his time in the service. And I didn't know enough to ask, Scott. You know, to me, you know, the name of the store was Norton's Laundry. To me and everyone else, he was Andy Norton. Okay? And you didn't screw around with Andy Norton. Okay? Things had to get done. Okay? And that was just kind of how I viewed things. He was a loving father, a great provider, and successful, but he never spoke about his military service.
Interesting. So you down the line, like many people that I talk to who have, you know, older parents who served in, you know, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and they, those folks just never really talk about their service. It's a very common thing that I've come to find that folks just didn't talk about it back then.
Yeah, they want to put it behind them.
They wanted to put it behind them.
And I don't blame them. Door.
Right, exactly. Some of the stuff they probably saw was probably pretty terrible. And who wants to keep bringing that up? And quite frankly, who wants to expose their loved ones to some of those tragedies and those terrors and things like that, right? But as you get older, you know, as now obviously as an adult, it's one of those things you look back on and it's like, well, I wish I knew more. I wish I had all of this information. So when was it that you really took an interest in your father's military service?
Well, it was actually a couple of years ago. So when I moved from Maryland to Florida, I was, you know, going through all the boxes in my unfinished basement in Maryland, and boxes and boxes. And I remember taking out one small box and my dad's dog tags clanged to the concrete floor. And it was kind of just like a frozen moment in time. And I just stopped. And I was kind of thinking, why don't I know anything about his military service?
Yeah.
And as I started going through the box, I came across some interesting stuff. And you can see I have it in plastic. So I have his enlisted record and report of separation honorable discharge, his honorable discharge certificate from the Army, his separation qualification record, and the Air Force Technical Command. You're going to love this, Scott. This is, let it be known that Private First Class Andrew, no middle initial, Friedman has satisfactorily completed the supply clerical course. Okay.
Sure.
So Scott, these four documents are the only facts that I have about my dad's military career. There are no other facts. So after looking at them and studying them, I told myself I wanted to write a story about my dad. And it's only 8,000 words, around 16 single space pages. You know, it's not War and Peace. Okay. and I would interweave facts with what I kind of thought might have been reasonable to happen.
Okay.
You could say it's made up. I could say it's near fact. Sure. We're both partially correct.
Yeah, it's about as close as you can get when you're trying to juice a rock.
There's right? no one to tell me, oh, Roger, you got that wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I wrote it and I knew that, you know, my mom was waiting at home and they got married after, you know, he came back. He worked in the laundry. They moved to Stuyvesant Town in Manhattan, which was... Think of this for a minute. I don't know if you've ever visited Manhattan.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. On the Lower East Side, from 14th Street to 20th Street, there was a sprawling project called Stuyvesant Town.
Okay.
And a smaller one called Peter Cooper Village. So Stuyvesant Town sits on about 500 or 600 acres. Prime Manhattan real estate. 80 apartment buildings, each 12 stories tall, in a park-like setting with fountains and playgrounds. It's literally a self-contained city with its own maintenance and guard force. It was built and run by Metropolitan Life Insurance Company for returning servicemen.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And this was in the 1940s. And a two-bedroom apartment was between $50 and $90.
Wow.
Now, I remember when I was growing up and I was a busybody that looked at things I should not have looked at. But when I was in, I don't know, when I was like 13 years old, I remember seeing the rent bill, which came in the mail, you know, every month. And it was $165 for a three-bedroom apartment with one bathroom. There was no air conditioning in Stuyvesant Town. Everyone had the double Hunter fan. Mm-hmm. In their kitchen, that was the only thing that kept you cool in the summer. But $165. Now, a three-bedroom in Stuyvesant Town is around $6,000 a month.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's significantly higher at this point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. So you pieced together what you could. I mean, there's some stuff that wasn't explicitly written in those documents, but just based on things like dates, you were able to kind of deduce.
Exactly.
That, okay. They got married after the fact. And I worked
around all those dates.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, so you worked around all that stuff and you pieced together to the best of your ability, what you suspect might be the story that your dad would have told had he had it, had that kind of,
he enlisted December 8th of 42. Okay. And he was in the Army Air Force for just under 3 years.
So, and do you know whereabouts he served? Was it in the Pacific?
Yes.
Or,
yes.
You know, whereabouts was he?
Is that in that document? At times he was in the Rhine Valley.
Okay.
But initially, he was in the 18th Bomb Squadron at RAF, Royal Air Force, Mendlesham, near Suffolk, England.
Oh, okay.
And it was a U.S. Army Air Force shared base with the Royal Air Force. And he was there for a long, long time.
So even with that little bit of information, it's not a ton of information, but you could probably deduce a little bit more.
Yeah, because then I Googled RAF Mendel, and I learned it was a sprawling air base, literally the size of Dallas.
Sure. Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I Googled a lot of facts to back up what I was writing about in the story.
So the desire to write the story, to put that out there in a written form, where did that come from?
Even though I've been a financial professional for 42, 43 years, I like to write. I've written 7 books. Most of them are on retirement, wealth planning, wealth accumulation, things of that nature. My last book, Erasing America, was the first one on politics, but I enjoy writing and I write every week. I probably write every day.
Okay.
So, you know, putting it down on paper, you know, you could tell I got a face made for radio. Okay. So, you know, the point is I figured I wouldn't be a television star, but I could write.
Now, I don't
have any grammar skills, mind you. I send everything to an old English professor in Minnesota, and she basically takes the scalpel to everything I write, because otherwise, if you showed it to an English teacher, she'd have a stroke, you know, in between taking her red pen.
I laugh the way you said that before. I always tell people I have a face for radio, but a voice for print. And
even better. Yes, I got it.
But it's interesting because you mentioned how before the war, your dad was going to school for journalism.
Yeah, he wanted to be Clark Kent.
Right. And, you know, when you think about it, you know, that seems like that's in your blood, in your genes, because it's like, maybe that's,
you know, I hadn't thought about that in a long time, but you're absolutely correct.
Yeah. And
score one for Scott.
You still enjoy doing it. Right. And yeah. I think that's a kind of an important thing to think about too, because, you know, just because your career is one thing, you may have a passion for something else. In your case, it's writing, and you really enjoy doing it, and you do it, you know, whenever you can. You've written several books. You and I were talking before about your blog. You have lots of information out on there, and you're writing constantly. And it's like, that's okay. Like that in a way, it could be a, you know, a hobby, or it could be a business or something.
I like to lift weights 4 to 5 days a week. Yeah. I like to walk down by the water, and I like to write, you know?
So, and that's wonderful, you know? And I think the reason why I bring that up is because I think there's a lesson there for some folks who, they go to their job, and it's maybe not fulfilling. You know, it's maybe not the thing that really scratches that itch for them. They have these other interests and other hobbies. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be a career per se. It could just be, like you said, you like to lift weights,
and you don't walk by the water. You don't have to be good at it.
Okay? Yeah.
You know, no one's going to look at it. You could just, you know, make your own journal, you know, get a book of blank pages, for God's sakes.
Right.
And no one's going to correct your grammar. It's just your own thoughts to be shared, you know, with you. If you want to share it with anyone else, all fine and well.
Sure.
But there is nothing that says that is necessary.
No, exactly. And I think perhaps even better, you know, because if it was your job and you weren't all that great at it, but you enjoyed it.
Kind of like a 13-year-old girl's diary, you know?
Yeah. Why not? You know, and let it be that. I mean, maybe with fewer hearts drawn in the margin and whatnot.
And here's something to think about. You know, a lot of veterans, you know, I belong to the Sons of the American Legion, and the meetings are at the American Legion Hall, our post. And I get to talk to a lot of vets and a lot of sons and daughters of vets. And, you know, I hear the same thing many, many times, that they're very, very proud to have served, or their parents have served, but they know very, very little about what actually transpired with their parents. And if the veteran were to keep their own diary just for their own self, but one day stick the damn thing in a safe deposit box or a safe with a note to be opened after my death, they don't have to get up in front of their family and say, I did this or I did that. Yeah. But their family at least could understand what transpired while on active military service, and have an appreciation, and that knowledge is not lost with the next generations.
That's right. Yeah. And I think a lot of us recognize that our military service changes who we are as far as our personality and the way we handle things. You know, especially if you've experienced any sort of traumatic incidents, like on a deployment, there's a lot of stuff that does change who we are. And other people may not necessarily recognize that in us, but you know, you can
raise some very interesting points. So have you ever heard of Sam Brown?
No.
So Sam Brown was deployed, I think it was either Iraq or Afghanistan, and he was severely injured in an IED accident. And he had dozens of surgeries. He is disfigured. And he's running for Congress.
Okay.
And I put money to his campaign not 2 or 3 weeks ago. And he's a proud serviceman. And looking at him, it's kind of hard to look at him because, you know, but I have to give him all the credit in the world for standing up and coming to the conclusion that even though he has faced all these traumatic events and dozens of surgeries, he has a strong voice. It is best to be heard in Congress and to help shape, you know, policy.
Well, I think there's one thing. There's a lot of people who served in the military and then go on to serve, whether it on the federal level in Congress or the Senate or,
I met Corey Mills in Florida about a year ago. I was very, very impressed with him.
Yeah. Even on the local level, they serve, you know, in their local, city council and other capacities like that. I think there's something in a lot of service members that there's that key word service. You know, they want to continue serving in one capacity or another. And people who, Sam Brown, who you're mentioning, who maybe physically isn't capable of serving in a military capacity anymore. And I don't know the specifics of his background and everything, so I'm making that assumption. But there's other ways to serve, right?
Exactly.
And so for those folks who maybe are struggling in that capacity, there are other ways. There are other things that you can do. And maybe politics isn't that thing for you, but there's other things that you can do as well. I want to get back to you and your family and your father's story and all of that. For you, what would you have hoped that your dad would have been able to share with you about his military experiences, as far as like maybe some holes that you had in the story that in his story that you wanted to fill? Like if you could just be like, hey, Dad, tell me about this thing, like what were some of those things that you could have filled?
First,
in the
I have to figure out when that would have been, because when I went off to college, me and my pop were not really getting along all that well. And okay. I put the onus on me. So I went to a state university school in the armpit of Rochester and Buffalo, New York. It was kind of cold. And there were two things that made me go to that school. Number one is I was invited. And I was not invited to many schools.
Okay.
Number two was it was far away from my dad while still in New York State in the public school system. So, but over time, we became friends again.
Okay.
You know, basically toward my junior and senior year and after college. But I understand that he was a clerical person. He was in charge of payroll, making sure that if somebody was killed in combat, that the family received all of the benefits that were due them. Mm-hmm. He was in charge of 25 people. They were in charge of payroll for over 3,000 people in a division. And he was skilled in the typewriter and the mimeograph, not a carbine, or three different pistols, although he learned that at basic training in Atlantic City. But his days were the mimeograph and the typewriter and bossing around 25 men.
Okay.
Not everyone is a Rambo. I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. But what I wrote about in the story was, I'm sure that he went through times of absolute boredom interspersed with terror.
Sure. Yeah.
And I tried to piece that together in my story. You know, they'd be having lunch in the mess tent and all of a sudden bombs would be dropping, fuel depots would be exploding, planes would be exploding, and people he worked with every day would be dying around him.
Yeah.
And that's what I believed occurred. And I wrote about that.
You know, and it's interesting too, because like you said, there's a lot of unanswered questions that you know, things that you piece together, and you could have gone a lot of different ways with the short story that you created. But based on the information that you had available to you and kind of just your thoughts, your feelings and, you know, and everything that, that went into it. And I think it's great that you were able to put something together like that. Right. Now for the veterans who might be out there who are listening, you know, are there any piece of advice you might give them as far as, you know, how to share their story or maybe from another perspective, you know, from the family members, who want to support those veterans in sharing their stories and preserving their legacies. You know, I know you mentioned before, you know, write it down in a journal and stick it in a safe deposit box and don't open it until after I'm gone.
That's
right.
Just one way to do it.
Yeah.
Another way comes to mind because, you know, years ago, my grandma Rose, my dad's mom, we interviewed her with a cassette recorder and a microphone in the 90s. And she told us how she was born a day's carriage ride from Minsk. Okay. I think that's about 100 miles.
Okay.
Maybe less. But we just kept asking her questions. Now, understand, Grandma Rose had no clue where she was or what she had for lunch the day before. But she remembered the village near Minsk. She remembered that mom and dad had a country store and that no one worked for anyone. Everyone, you know, was the butcher or the candle maker or the leather tanner. You know, there were no corporations. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Everyone was solopreneur. So, you know, my sense is that a family could gather around and say, Mom, Dad, you know, we would like to understand more about your years in service. Would it be okay for us to write down some questions and maybe you could answer them, you know, while we have the iPhone going or a tape mm-hmm. recorder or, you know, whatever, so that we can have this as your legacy when you're no longer here.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing is to ask permission, mm-hmm. to be very, very humble and loving about it. And if the answer is no, I don't know, maybe go back in 6 months and try again.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, some degree of persistence without being obnoxious about it, I think is good. Yeah. You know, but because that initial, can I do this type of thing? They may catch them off guard. Maybe they need to sit on it and think about it for a little bit and say, you know, maybe I really do want to share it, but maybe at that moment wasn't the right time to do it. Right?
And you want to be thoughtful
in
the questions that you ask. You probably don't want to say, what was your most terrifying moment? Because you don't want them to relive that.
Yeah.
But, you know, ask them what their days were like. What was it like carrying a 40-pound sack through the rainforest, you know, whatever it was.
Whatever, yeah.
You know, tell me about your day-to-day. Tell me about the friendships that were created during that time. Did you stay in touch with those people?
Yeah.
My Uncle George, who was not really my uncle, did you serve with him?
Yeah, right, exactly. I remember before my grandfather passed away, he grew up in Poland, and he was there during the World War II time period.
I had a grandmother and grandfather in Poland, yes.
Yeah, and he didn't serve in the military, but he was captured by the Nazis, and so he saw his fair share of the atrocities that took place over there. But one day, just about his life in general, it was just, you know, how did he get to school? And he talked about how it was this long walk that he had to go to school, and they were poor, they didn't have any money. So a lot of times he didn't have shoes to wear. And in the winters, he'd walk barefoot in the snow, and his feet would be like, felt like they were about to fall off. But he was talking about that. And I had it all recorded. And then after he passed away, I had that, you know, that I was able to share with
that's, you know, wonderful. Folks. And, you know, our young people, as I like to call them, have little to no appreciation whatsoever for American history and for all the veterans who gave everything so that they could sit on their ass at Starbucks or, okay, don't get me started. Sure. But the point is, when I was a kid in junior high school, Scott, there was a course called Civics. Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Okay. And it basically attempted to teach us how to be a good American citizen. Okay. What was expected of you? You should register to vote when you're 18 or 21. You should pay taxes and not be a criminal. You should raise a family and be honest and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember the girls at the same time as the civics course, they had home economics, which was a nice phrase for cooking. Okay. But I remember that we came away with an appreciation of what it was to be an American as opposed to the people that were in the USSR, because at the time we were scared stiff of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And Manhattan was target number one.
I'm sure.
Or the Pentagon was target number one.
Yeah, sure. It was pretty, it was up there on the list.
It was on the target list.
Yeah, exactly.
And my sense is that today's junior high school students and college students need civics classes because it ain't there.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of the appreciation that you're talking about, like the lack of appreciation, comes from maybe just not having these stories available to them.
That's an excellent point.
You know, if you never knew the struggles that somebody went through, then you may not appreciate how good you have it, if that makes sense. So, yeah. You know, when you think about, like, if everything is rainbows and unicorns and everything's fine and dandy,
you get complacent.
Yeah, very much so. And then you don't appreciate the struggles that somebody else may have had. Yeah. And you may not even recognize in yourself that, hey, that could be me. Yeah. If I'm not careful, right?
I have two ideas about this. Number one, sure, is I know that Israel has a compulsory military service. I think it's between 2 and 4 years. I'm not mm-hmm. sure. North Korea, I think, is 10 years. Okay. but I think that with the diminished size of our armed forces, I think a compulsory service requirement of 4 years is absolutely doable and in the country's best interest for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
And to take it a step further, I'm also in favor of, so you want to be a U.S. citizen, okay, here are five doors. You know the five doors I'm going to tell you. Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard. Choose one of those five doors and you're going to serve for 6 years to become an American citizen. And at the end of 6 years, we give you a free ride to any state university or college, not Harvard, state school.
Sure.
Okay. And you will be a American citizen with a honorable past and a college degree or trade school degree.
Yeah. It's an interesting way to look at it. There's a lot of ways to, I guess, skin the cat. And I'm sure there's other ways to go about doing this as well. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I think that we're going back to that appreciation. You know, if we don't know the stories, just tying this back to, you know, kind of what we started talking about, if we don't know the stories, then we can't necessarily appreciate the struggle that somebody
You're exactly right, because kids don't have struggles nowadays.
Yeah, it's definitely not the same. It's hard for them to know these struggles, though, if these stories aren't being told.
And nowadays, up for an iPhone 16 is not a struggle.
No, it's not. But nowadays, it's so easy to be able to share a story in one way or another. If you don't
All the social media and everything else.
Exactly. And if you don't want to even make it public like that, if you don't like physically writing, whether it's typing or handwriting or whatever, if you don't like doing that, you have a phone, you have, you know, a camera on your phone, and you can record it and you can speak into it, or you can record yourself with a video if that's what you prefer.
Sure.
And you can take that and you can save that file somewhere and lock it away.
You can give it to your attorney.
It's somewhere. Yeah. You put it on a thumb drive and put it in a safe or something, you know, whatever. There's so many different ways. And even I think back to folks from like your father's generation, where if he was so inclined to write a book about his story, which, you know, obviously he wasn't, but
if he
was so inclined, the amount of hoops you'd have to jump through and money and all that stuff to find a publisher, to be able to publish the book and all that kind of stuff. It was a lot more prohibitive.
Or he could have gone on a Royal or Underwood typewriter.
It could have done something like that, right?
You know, typed out 20 pages and stick it in his drawer with a paperclip.
It wasn't quite as easy as it is today.
Oh, I know.
And so these days, the story can be told. I guess that's my point. And trying to get that out to other veterans, I think it's important. And just from your perspective and hearing your side of the story, I love hearing you know, the other side, the family side. Like, I wish I knew more, you know, and kind of to encourage the veterans who have served to share your story. I think we've covered, there's so many different ways that you can do it. You don't have to sit down in a, you know, roundtable discussion and have a whole big thing or present your case to your family or whatever. You don't have to do it even in person. You can tell it in one way or another.
To become involved in whatever way suits you. So for example, you know, I joined the Sons of the American Legion. I go to the meetings once a month. Once a month they have barbecues and I man the grill. You know, smoke in my eyes, but give me a cheeseburger, you know, we'll call it even. But I also give generously to the Gary Sinise Foundation, the USO, Wounded Warrior Project, Team Rubicon, and, you know, and those kind of places where I know that my money is being used to help veterans. And a lot of times there are veterans in need. And I am more than happy to share, you know, what I've created.
And that's amazing too. And being a part of those organizations, whether or not you've served, being part of an organization like that, it gives you that camaraderie. There's other people
I acknowledge your service and I want to help.
Yeah, exactly. Okay?
I can't pick up a gun. I'm 68 years old. You don't want me picking up a gun. But I can provide financial assistance.
Yeah, sure.
That I could do.
Yeah. But just being there, showing up, I think is important too, because that shows people that you actually give a damn.
Who was it? Woody Allen said 50% of success is just showing up.
I thought it was a Yogi Berra quote.
I don't know. Yogi Berra quote that I remember the most is, "Oh, that restaurant's too crowded. No one goes there anymore."
Well, Roger, it's been a pleasure having you on, sharing your story, sharing your father's story, and all the work that you did. Tell us where people can go to find out more information about you, your work, and your books. Tell us a little bit about that.
My best-selling book on Amazon is called Erasing America, Broken Politics, Broken Country. And obviously it's available on Amazon, which I think is the last bookstore on the planet. Okay. I'm not sure, but I think it is. I do have a website, eocritic.com, short for Equal Opportunity Critic. There's a link to Amazon on there. You can sign up for my bi-monthly update, which is about 2,500, 3,000 words sent to you automatically by email. I have a number of videos, YouTube videos, blogs, And fun stuff like that. No cotton candy or anything else.
Okay. Excellent. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes, you know, both to the book and also to your website.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for a great interview. I really appreciate it, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for taking the time to come on, and thanks for sharing your story and your father's story as well.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.